Hi, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. I'm your host, Megan Henry, and today I'm joined by Tracy Allen. And I'm delighted to have Tracy on. Tracy and I have worked together for a few years now. She is a senior litigation examiner at NAMICO, or NAMICO Insurance Company. But we're not really here to talk about, we talk a little bit about her current role, but more so of how she got where she was, because she started off not in claims at all and kind of developed some skills in that career that I personally think are crucial to her experience in claims and her career in claims. She worked in dealing with catastrophic injuries in response to those, and has made her way to where she is now, all while being a single mom. So I think her story is inspiring and interesting, and I think you'll enjoy it too. So with that, I'll bring her in.
This is the Claims Never Sleep podcast, presented by Cruiser Mitchell, with your host, Megan Henry.
Good morning, Tracy. Welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. How are you today?
I am well. I made it in. We are having some icy rain this morning, but I made it in safely. So,
Yeah, we just had a storm over the weekend. Like last week was one of these weeks that the kids had late openings multiple days and they didn't have school on Friday. So yesterday was like the Monday of all Mondays, like getting everyone out on time. It was, I felt like I had been in a boxing match by the time everyone got on the bus. So I was like, hey. To add insult to injury, my oldest one, then I got a call from the nurse like 2 hours later that she was having a stomach ache and I had to pick her up. And I was like, were you just not ready for the school weekend?
That's happened before. My son just happened to be sick right after I take you. But I mean, I'm sure she was really sick. My son wasn't.
She was fine. She seemed just fine laying on the couch all afternoon. But yes, I think she needed a little more time to ease into the week. I get it. Don't we all need? I feel like when you have those long weekends, it's just so hard to get back into the swing of things. And I was even saying the week before when they were having the delayed openings make the mornings go so much smoother, because I can still get up and do my things. And I just like getting them up and out the door just doesn't have that big rush to it anymore.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But we're not here to talk about the weather.
No, ma'am.
Well, Tracy, I'm so glad that you joined me. You and I have worked together for a while now, but you have an amazing backstory that I was so grateful that you were willing to share it, because I think you're amazing. You're amazing. And I think everyone should know how amazing Tracy is. But before we like really dig in, because part of the story is your background, you are in claims now, but you didn't start off in claims. No. And you started in a really interesting, I think really interesting career of, you're a 911 operator.
I was. But even before that, so I don't know where me wanting to be an attorney came from, but I've always wanted to be an attorney. So when I went to college, you know, I did my first 2 years at Purdue and then I finished at Ball State. My senior year, I changed my mind. I'm like, what do I do? So I ended up going to Atlanta because a friend was there. And even before I landed on being a 911 operator, I think I was a secretary, I was a collection agent. I did retail. I was a waitress. And then I became a 911 operator.
Well, so as a collections agent, that has to be just a terrible job.
It is. I think I was there for maybe 3 months.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
Yeah, my dad was in the car industry and he started off being like the repo man, which is also terrible. You know, like you understand like why things need to happen, but then you feel for taking the individual's vehicle, you know, because they haven't paid. But there's reasons behind it typically, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I try to take away something out of every job I've had. And that is where I learned that if you just talk to the collection agent, stop avoiding their calls, stop, you know, just talk to them, say, hey, you're either going to get what I can give you, or let's make some arrangements. It's just when people like ignore them that it becomes like harassing. So luckily there's laws against that now of collection agents harassing people. So,
well, let me ask you this though. So you said you wanted to be an attorney for as long as you can remember. So do you remember what made you like make the change that you're like, oh, maybe I don't want to do this?
So I did an internship, I believe it's called the Washington Center in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And you can get like an internship on the Hill, the White House. So I chose my internship with a defense attorney. So I was like, if I'm having doubts now, let me make sure it's not what I want to do. So I did it with her, and she was just this fiery, short, redhead lady. She was just amazing, but took me to court one day. And it was kind of cool. I don't know if you remember, is it Murder on 1600 with Wesley Snipes, where there's a murder at the White House? So I was there when they were filming that, and I got to walk through the set, and I met Wesley, and I was all giddy. He's like, hey, how you doing?
Just like being like, an attorney. That's like a weird night.
So that was one perk. That day we went to court, it was a sentencing hearing, and the guy was sentenced. I can't remember this, but his girlfriend with the baby was behind me and his mother. When the judge handed down the sentence, all I heard was screaming. And then I felt the purse go by my head because she threw it at the judge. So I was like, so they're going crazy. And I'm just like, give me the baby. Just give me the baby. So I'm like, I don't think I could handle this on a regular basis. But I found myself in the middle of trying to care for a baby I didn't know, because they were upset and crying and yelling at the judge. So it was just something I just knew I didn't want to be a part of.
Yeah. I can understand that, because that's difficult. And it just says, like, as a individual, it's difficult, even though someone may have made some poor choices, you know, and.
Yeah. But it affects the family too. Then people don't think about that. You know, it's not just your life. You're ruining other people's lives.
Yeah. How did you end up going into being a 911 operator? Because I think, because you're such a compassionate person, so that must have been, I could like see you doing it, but a very hard on you mentally, but I could see you like really.
It was. But that's where I got my thick skin from. I would not have been able to do claims without a thick skin. And I don't remember how I came across that. I think it just sounded interesting. We were part of the police department, which was cool. But, you know, I've always wanted to help people. So when I got on the floor, it was pretty hard. You know, I'm from Indiana, and even though people think I am from the South because of the way I talk, but trying to hear the callers and understand them, it wasn't easy because, you know, it's just we talk different region to region. But the interesting thing about that is that, yes, I had some pretty important phone calls that kind of changed my life, some traumatic, some dealing with death. But the one, of course, that I did deliver a baby over the phone. Yeah. It was a 14-year-old, and her mother called, and she was like, you know, she's in labor, and she was just hysterical. And she's like, okay, I got to get off the phone. I got to get dressed. I said, no. You can't get dressed now. You have to tend to your daughter. And so she just kept going on about the nightgown she had on. I was like, it's okay. The baby's more important. So I gave her instructions on how to, you know, she had to take off her pants and things like that. And as soon as she did, she's like, oh my God, a head full of hair. Here it comes. And so the baby did come out and I heard it cry. EMS got there like right after that. But that was pretty amazing. So
how is how does the training work for that? Like, because clearly you had not done that before. So
No. So yeah. And any, well, back then, so this was 98 or 97 or something like that. I can't remember. We had a lot of training, like I think it probably at least a few months, but it's a triage system. We have a triage book. You get the call, and depending on what their answers are, will you go on into the triage or do you hang up? Do you stay on the line? Do you transfer to someone else? So there was just a triage book that we had to learn. And of course, you had to learn it and know what to do, what page to go to, because, you know, they're having an emergency. They don't have time for you to flipping through a book. Wait a minute, I got to go to page 2. No, page 15. No. So it wasn't none of that. You had to really know your stuff. So, and I believe it was like, color code, it had tabs, so it was easy to maneuver, but so that was pretty interesting. I was very good at it, I can say that. The numbers proved it. I took the most calls, was on the calls less time. And I can't remember what else we were measured on, but I got picked to develop the SOP, the standard operating procedures for Fulton County 911, because they didn't have one. I'm like, why don't you have an SOP? So that was pretty cool that we got to work on that project together. So
what did you find? I'm going to stick with this for a little bit because I'm just fascinated by it. But like, what are some of I'm sure there's like just common calls you get all the time that you're like, my goodness, why are they calling 911 about this?
Well, one thing that kind of made me upset was this lady called about a car being driven by a Black man, but it had South Dakota plates. And she's like, I'm from South Dakota. I don't know. It was just, I was like, ma'am, this is not an emergency. Goodbye. So I hung up on her, but I told my supervisor right away, if she calls back complaining, this is what I did, and I stand by it. You know, I'm not going to entertain any of that stuff. Mostly people, I mean, they call just like you hear on the radio. I did get some calls about a robbery in progress, a lot of car accidents, of course. Some people just want to talk. Yeah. There are some older people that will call and just want to talk to you. And so sometimes that's okay if the lines are clear, right? Because we could see, of course, on the board, whether or not we had calls coming in, anything waiting, people off on their break. So you don't have time to have personal discussions with.
Yeah. like, would you have like regulars, like people who would call like frequently to be like, oh, I want to talk to Tracy.
I remember a couple of people. I remember it was an older man. And so we had to learn the police codes for a lot of things. And 24 was, I believe it was 24, like a person maybe with mental health issues and things like that. So we would get calls from them a lot because they just want to talk, or they say something off that we don't understand anything they're talking about. But we have to listen to the call to determine whether or not we need to disconnect or actually take action. So.
Yeah. And like, I imagine you have to take every call very seriously. And kind of like triage through it, being like, okay, like almost put it in categories of buckets. Like, okay, is this like a super emergency? Is this like light? Mm-hmm. Like that's how I would imagine. It's almost like you have like levels of
urgency. Oh yeah. Yeah. And one thing that we did change there was that, you know, you hear 911, what is your emergency? And we changed it to where. That's the first question that we ask, because sometimes you don't get a chance to ask where you are because they're talking about the emergency. And we're like, we got to confirm where you are, even though it comes up on the monitor where you're calling from.
Got it.
You know, so the first important question is, where is your emergency? And so I thought that was a great idea, because if you can only imagine people that call and are in distress, they don't really get around to telling you where they are. And then they end up hanging up, or fortunately get involved in some traumatic physical confrontation or something. So, yeah.
Well, how long did you do that for?
I think almost 2 years.
Okay.
I think almost 2 years.
And did you segue from that into claims, or did you?
Yes. Because of course, at that time, like, I didn't have a plan after college. I planned not to go to law school. So my plan, I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I was always looking for more money. And I went to a job fair, and Progressive Insurance was there. That was my first job. Mm-hmm. And at that time, Progressive was just very popular with their immediate response vehicle, all the cool commercials and all that. And I believe they were a sponsor of the Super Bowl maybe a year after I started. So there was a lot going on with Progressive that was exciting.
So you started at Progressive, and what sort of claims were you handling when you were there? Was it?
I wasn't handling claims. I was handling tow claims, but I was actually a dispatcher. So I was taken in, I would set up the claims and then assign them to the adjusters. And of course, the adjusters also worked outside, you know, in the IRV. They would to make the visits. So I would dispatch them saying, hey, here's your next claim. We need an immediate response to this. Okay. So I was like kind of like a dispatcher. And I felt like I wasn't going anywhere. So that's how I ended up going to another insurance company. So I would handle like tow claims, rental claims, little stuff.
But so I kind of see like the segue from going from like 911 to that, like it kind of like, there's some translatable skills, I think, there. So you're still, you know, you're still kind of dealing with people in distress and, you know, managing that. So I understand like kind of how that could have segued in, but I also understand why you're like, okay, I don't see my upwards.
And I'm pretty, I wouldn't say I'm that ambitious, but I just knew that I need to make some progress faster. So I landed on the Hartford, and the Hartford had a substandard company, the Hartford Omni in Atlanta. That's where I really got into a lot of claims and claims handling and my initial experience in claims and stuff like that.
And eventually you moved on to handling being on a CAT team, right? And doing catastrophic response.
Yeah. In trucking. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So because you and I were talking about this, and this is like a huge part of your story that I find fascinating, because you move over to another company, you're dealing with catastrophic trucking claims the whole time being a single mom, right?
Yes. Yes. When I first started at that company, my son was two. And so I had to make sure before I accepted the job that my family was on board, because that job was in Bloomington, Indiana, which is like an hour south of Indianapolis, Indiana. But a part of the job being a part of the emergency response team was that you had 1 hour to get to our plane. So if you're assigned to this catastrophic loss, you have 1 hour to get your stuff together and get to the plane, the local airport, because we had our own Learjet to fly to the places in our territory. So, you know, I would get the call and I'm just like, can't talk to anybody until I get a sitter for my child. So luckily I've met one of my sorority sisters at that job, and her husband helped me a lot, and my parents. That was the only way I could do that job.
Yeah.
And so I had to make sure he was taken care of, who's going to pick him up, you know, who's going to feed him until I get back. And sometimes I had to stay overnight, you know, where I was.
And like, I can imagine the stress involved with that too. Like you literally have, I mean, I know you're on call, so you have to be somewhat prepared that you're going to get a call, but I'm sure there's many times when you're on call, you get no calls, right?
Yeah. Well, that was very rare for me, but it just seems like I just had the worst luck. So we were on call 1 week when I first started, maybe every 7 weeks, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. That's a lot. It seemed like I was going out at least twice a week, sometimes three. And so I just had bad luck like that. And then some people don't get called out a lot at all. So,
yeah. Now, your son is an adult now. Have you talked to him about like what he remembers from that time? Does he remember anything about it, or when, and what does he remember? Because it could have been fun for him being like, oh, I get to go see auntie, you know, so-and-so, or I get to be with Grammy here.
Well, you know, as time went on, my on-call pickup list got longer. So like, you know, the friends that he had, their parents helped me a lot. I know when it was all said and done, I may have had 10 people on the list that I could call to go get him. So he, in that aspect, he thought it was fun. Oh, I get to go over such and such house tonight and play with their dog and do things like that. But there were other times where I do remember being called away on Christmas evening. I don't understand why, because what I did could have waited till the next morning. Because they only called me to go to New York. They called me at like 7 p.m. And by the time I got there, all I did was go to the hotel. So I could have slept at home and then left like 4 or 5 o'clock in the next morning. So that happened a lot. So it was just a couple of times where I felt like me leaving my son was unnecessary.
Yeah. And that's so hard on you too, because you're doing it for your family, but then you're losing time with your family on some very key dates. And I know it is whatever you make of every day and all of that, but still, like, it's Christmas. You only get so many of them.
I couldn't take that anymore. Well, it took 16 years to figure out that I couldn't take it anymore.
I'm like, it wasn't a short day for you. So in the response to these cat calls, though, like, what were some things that you noticed, or you have to deal with catastrophic accidents, you're dealing with truck drivers involved in catastrophic accidents. And I'm sure in that you're pulling in all your prior experience of having to manage these traumatic events.
Yeah. So our priority for going to the scene, and we only responded to either fatal or catastrophic injuries. So most of the time we're going out, someone has passed away. And our main objective is to meet with our truck driver to make sure that evidence is secure. We interview them, get the paperwork. And of course, a lot of them are away from home. Their state's away from home and all they care about is getting home, but we got to keep them there. So that's a task. And then some drivers, regardless if it's their fault or not, they're still human. So they're traumatized, crying. Mm-hmm. And so we're having to be counselors, mothers, mm-hmm. you know, and all the while try to remain professional. So just one thing I always told them is I'm here to start the investigation, secure the evidence that will help us defend you, however this shakes out. But we don't want you to have to worry about this part of the claim. We want you to be able to go home and decompress and deal with what happened with your family. So just give me this half hour, hour of your time. Let me do my job and then you go home. That was not easy.
No, just being involved in any accident after the fact, people are shaken up. Now yeah. You have an added layer of being a catastrophic or fatality. I've seen it, how those drivers are. I mean, that sometimes they're in shock. Sometimes they shut mm-hmm. down. Sometimes they don't talk at all. Like, or sometimes they're inconsolable. Like, so again, you're pulling in these counselor problem solver skills to come in and kind of also being a mom, right?
because there's a lot of young drivers on the road, a lot of young truck drivers that just are trying to make a paycheck and they don't have a lot of life experience. So it's pretty hard.
From that experience though, was there anything that you noticed or picked up on from like this, like responding to the scenes of things that you're like, almost like better practices, ideas for like drivers, be like, maybe we should implement these changes.
Before I left that company, I was trying to get a meeting with the safety department because, of course, the safety department is who traveled out to our insured trucking companies and went over whatever safety guidelines or requirements they needed to meet, for their policies. And so I just had all these ideas. I'm like, especially like at that time, more and more drivers were getting dash cameras, mm-hmm. but some of them thought they couldn't afford them. I had started looking up dash cameras that were affordable and things like that. Also, once you're in an accident, if you don't have a camera, if it's safe to get out your truck, snap a picture of the placement of the vehicles and get back in your truck and then move off to the side of the road. Just something as simple as that, because of course, right after an accident, the placement of the vehicles are very important to the investigation. No, I had a whole list of things and I was trying to get a meeting. So I'm like, if you just do these little things, you know, it'd make our job so much easier. So
yeah. And I think some of it's instinctive, right? Like you don't want to be blocking a road or you want to pull off to the side. Mm-hmm. And it's like, not that they don't think, but they're not thinking about that aspect of it. They're just thinking of, okay, I was in an accident. I need to call my supervisor. I need to move this tractor trailer to the side. I'm blocking. Mm-hmm. And that's why they need professionals like yourself to be like, okay, this should be in the safety protocol response manual of how you respond if this event, if an event were to happen. Because I see it on my side too, when, you know, sometimes you're lucky enough to be there, but most times you're not. And then you're looking back and you're piecing together the accident. Yeah, and then you have an expert come in piecing together mm-hmm. the accident. Mm-hmm. And when things are moved or changed, it's sometimes can really, really hurt the litigation side of things.
Yeah. And then also as humans, we want to apologize and, mm-hmm. you know, go console the other party or, I mean, even just in regular accidents, not all catastrophic accidents, but there's a way to show empathy without admitting liability. And so I just think like that should be a part of safety and coaching of these drivers, how to manage your emotions on the scene, if you can. We're all human, but and then how to manage others. Because you have people, other drivers, witnesses that are hostile towards truck drivers and they don't feel safe. So a lot of times they don't get out of their trucks. It's a lot. It's a lot they go through. I have a lot of respect for truck drivers.
Yeah, it's not an easy job. Mm-hmm. It can be a very lonely job too. And they're driving giant, giant vehicles.
Thousands of pounds without cargo.
Yeah, with it, yes, exactly. Then load it up, and it's even harder. And then a lot of times driving in very desolate places, though, too.
Yeah, a lot of accidents don't occur in the city. It's just like way out in rural areas, though.
But was there anything that, looking back now, that you're like you mentioned, like taking the photograph, if you don't have the dash cam or whatever, like anything looking back that you're like, oh, these were some best practices that I saw to be beneficial, or that things that should be implemented in when you're in a catastrophic type accident?
You know, of course, that would vary from the situation, mm-hmm. because it's all up to the driver and what he can handle. And of course, you have to be respectful. Like if it's a fatal accident, you don't want to, a lot of our drivers just say, oh, I just stayed back, or a witness went up to, I just let the witness handle it. You know, they didn't want to see the bodies or see what they have done. You know, even if it's not their fault, they feel responsible. So I just think that, you know, they're given protocols that they have to do, of course. And then also a Department of Transportation standpoint, they know they're about to be under a lot of scrutiny and inspections mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So I don't know, just from all those years working with them, it's like nothing will fit every driver on what they should do in those situations. Yeah. So I just think that if they just learn to be aware of the environment that they're in after this accident, the people who are around, and if you are able to just take notes or mental notes of the environment, because that's important too, and then start thinking about what the chain of events were that led to the impact, and sometimes try to get that down in your mind before all the chaos.
Yeah.
Because pretty much when the police arrive, it just takes a whole nother direction. So, yeah.
Well, one thing that I've taken note of with defending to these types of accidents is the importance of like making sure all your pre-ride checks are done and documented and consistently, and that you have all of the things you're supposed to have in the vehicle. Like you have the manuals, you have your logs, mm-hmm. these things, which I know most of probably 9 times out of 10, they're there, but one time that they're not, it can prove to be very problematic. Even if it's a non-issue, then a skilled plaintiff's attorney is going to make that an issue.
Yeah, especially the logs. Yeah. And, you know, now I believe they're all electronic, or most of them that have the capability of being electronic. They don't have, their truck isn't that old, but the logs are the main thing. You just have some people who just don't know how to do their logs. So, and then you see a lot of bad editing to the logs. So you get caught every time because it's very obvious. And when they start matching that up with if you have GPS on your truck and receipts. And so it's just best not to fudge on those. So
no,
at all.
And especially now, everything is so digital that mm-hmm. you can't really fudge it. I think when things were more on paper in the gold, mm-hmm. the old days.
Yeah, and that's all I remember. It's like paper logs.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of it still is, or it's like on tablets that's like transposed or transferred to paper logs, but like you use the tablet to do all the checks. I've just found in defending these cases, anything that's just, even if the smallest little thing, if that step was skipped in that instant, that then becomes an issue. Yeah. Whether or not it had nothing to do with the accident at all, it'll be used as an inference that, well, this wasn't done, then maybe this wasn't done either.
And, you know, and of course, another important thing, you talk about a driver's mental state after those things and they just want to get home, or they just trying to gather themselves. Well, you still got to go get a drug and alcohol test within a certain period of time. And so a lot of times by the time I get to the scene, those deadlines have expired. So it's like, what do you do with that?
Because the inference right there is going to be, well, there must have been something going on if they didn't have the test in time. I can already picture it.
Yeah, we had a bad accident. It was a fatality in Maryland. I don't know if it was close to Baltimore. And so Maryland's a contributory negligence state, right?
Yeah.
1% of cars recovery. So it was totally the other guy's fault. But our driver went partying the night before and had marijuana in the system. So I believe they ended up like trying to hurry up and settle that before all that came out. even though it wasn't his fault and there was good defenses, liability defenses that we could prove 1%, you know, negligence, they just still settled it because they didn't want our driver's drug test to come out.
Well, I can just imagine the publicity that could be associated with that, that could be detrimental to the company. Yeah. You don't necessarily want that out there either. Mm-hmm. I'm not a toxicologist, but I think that stays in your system for some time. It could have even been
several weeks. But
looking at it from like a trial attorney standpoint, like that, you're going to blow that up.
Yeah. I did not care that she went to a party 3 weeks ago. It's still in your system.
Did you ever experience an incident, though, that perhaps the driver had been engaging in some of that activity, like not far away from the incident that could have impacted it?
Oh, goodness. I don't think I have come across anything specific to that, but I did have like this one driver that stands out that was hostile towards me and was uncooperative. And I'm like, well, what are you covering up? What don't you want me to know? And I had to convince him, like, I'm on your side. I'm here to try to make sure that whatever evidence we need, or even if you have something adverse or something that's going to hurt you, you need to tell me now so that we can get in front of it and know how to address it. And of course, like most of the times, defense counsel has already been dispatched to. They'll come to the scene and kind of talk to the drivers because they represent the drivers. So that sometimes helped with these type of drivers that are uncooperative and you think they're covering up
things. I would think having counsel there is a layer of protection and helpfulness for the driver too, that they feel like they could be insulated a little bit because you can talk to their attorney under, you know, attorney-client privilege. However, I could also see how it could hurt in a way that maybe the driver's not so on board with talking to this other individual, and they might not understand the complexities of the investigation, what's going on, and it might even cause more hostility. So I can see it kind of cutting both ways.
Oh yeah.
So again, during this whole time, during these 16 years, you start this when your son is 2, you know, you do all the way until basically he's graduating high school. I know we talked about when he was younger, but as he grew older, did he gain like this appreciation to everything that you were doing and the importance of your job?
Oh yeah. Yeah. He still didn't understand why they were sending me out at night and overnight. And of course, as he got older, I needed to keep an eye on him. He is a young boy growing up, and the internet, the games, the Xbox, playing with strangers online, you know, things like that I had to also manage. But he, when I wasn't around, of course, some kids take advantage of that and say, hey, this is free time for me to do little things that maybe my mom wouldn't appreciate. So I had growing pains too, just like any other parent. Yeah. No, now you can tell that he appreciated what I did and some sacrifices I made to do that job. In 2015, I got breast cancer. So that was hard on him too. And he had to watch his favorite teacher go through that too at the same time.
Oh.
So it was hard on him, very hard.
Yeah.
But I continued to work during that time. So
really? Wow.
Yeah. So that was one thing about my job. I guess with most jobs, like if you work most of the day, like 4 hours, that you don't have to take leave, or the 3.5 hours with chemotherapy, you don't get sick until like 2 days later. So I would get Thursday afternoon, you know, I work Thursday morning, chemo Thursday afternoon, work all day Friday, be sick all weekend and come back to work Monday. So I never missed any work. I'm grateful that they worked with me on that, so I wouldn't have to take so much leave of absence.
But that must have been hard on him too, though, because you'd be sick on the weekends too, which is a lot of the time that you probably would have together. And I'm sure he had a little bit of caretaker role too, which is wonderful and great. And but it's still hard for a teenager too.
But that was at a time where I think he also became a little distant, because I would tell him, mommy's not well enough to look out for you, so no, you can't go outside. I had to start limiting his activities because I couldn't take care of him, you know, so he probably was a little resentful for a little bit.
Well, I'm so happy that you made it through all that. I mean, I feel like your story is just inspiring because you've had a lot of challenges and have pushed through them all. During that time, though, during that like teenage time when it went your way, like, were there ever times that you like caught him or his friends trying to be sneaky, trying to get away with stuff while you were out of town?
Because I come home late and I'm like, where are you? So there's a nice little app called Life 360.
Yeah.
So I think it was like when he got to be like a sophomore and he got a cell phone that I'm like, you have to keep your location on the, you know, give me a peace of mind while I'm not there. But he was a good boy. He was good. He was a good kid. He just, like every teenager, you got those temptations. And if you're not around a lot to catch them, you kind of got to do some backhanded, you catch it on the back end and try to fix it later. But yeah.
I mean, I remember that growing up, like, you knew whose house the parents worked longer, that, you know, no one was home, and you knew where you could go in the afternoon.
And that was my house for his friends. They was like, your mom's out of town, okay. I'm going over to DJ's house.
And that's hard as a parent, though, too, because you want to hope, like, okay, first of all, teenagers are going to make poor choices. You just hope they don't make terrible, terrible choices. They're going to have to make some poor choices and learn from them. But you also don't want them to get involved with the wrong crowd and just take a turn in the wrong direction, all while, like, it's not like you're off gallivanting and leaving him to his own devices. Like, you're away because you're trying to provide for your family, not because you're on a girls trip or can't be bothered. So it's a hard balance.
Yeah, I got no breaks. I've never experienced sending him off for the summer with family member. He was with me every day of his life. I don't even know what that feels like.
I would think, though, looking back, though, you're probably grateful for all that too.
Yeah. We're awfully close. I think he respects me, which is a great thing to get from a teenager. Things happen for a reason.
Yeah. But you eventually did make a change and leave this position. And I imagine because you probably wanted some more, not stability, but like constant, just not moving, maybe.
Yes. Yeah, I truly only stayed in Bloomington until he graduated. And I didn't want to leave that position without finding one doing something different. It made no sense to me to go to another company and handle trucking claims. Like, that never made sense to me to job hop to the same thing. So if I was going to leave, it was going to be for something different. So when I got the opportunity, I wasn't even looking for a job. Someone called me about this position in professional liability. So I appreciate them. That's one thing that I tell my son is, like, you have to care about the relationships that you build, that you damage, that you cut off, whatever, because you never know, you know, when those people that you've had those issues with may be important later. So I just firmly believe in not burning bridges, and not that I had a bridge to burn with this person, but she just told me that I was nice to her while we worked together, and she thought about me when she found this job. So she called me. So that made me feel good that I'm adding value to those relationships that I build. So people will in turn think about me for opportunities. So
yeah. But I think the key is there, though. You're adding value not with the expectation of getting something back, but just because you want to add value. That's the difference. Like, you're not in it for something. You're just doing it from, you know, the goodness of your own heart. You're a kind, caring, nice person, you know, and it all just comes around, you know?
Yeah, that's important to me. Every day I try to be a good person. You know, every day it's just no reason to be anything else. It's really not. Yeah. You know, even when someone does something against you, just remove yourself from that situation if you can. Remove yourself from that person.
But how was the pivot for you, though, from trucking and dealing with these catastrophic claims then to pivot over to professional liability, which is similar but very different? I mean, there's similarities, but first of all, you've cut out the response, the cat response. Yes. But the nature of the claims is very, very different, but still has big emotional aspect to them. You know, how is that transition for you?
It does. So the bulk of our claims are dealing with bad faith, mm-hmm. and a insurance companies. So the thing that I did as an adjuster was try to handle claims, manage claims in good faith, to make reasonable offers, to make sure denials were, I guess, factually based and had merit and you had the support for it, you know, things like that, that you had good customer service, that you, even if you're giving bad news to a policyholder, do it and just get it over with. So those things that I see on this end, why is bad faith even being alleged? I'm like, okay, did you tell the insured A, B, and C? Did you tell them this may be an issue or a challenge or an exclusion or whatever it is? Were you just honest with them? Were you upfront with them? And then when they send you information, did you act upon it or did you just leave it on your desk and thought ignoring it would make it disappear? So it's just ironic that I'm on this end of it with those claims. I'm finding that the experience I had at the prior company is helping me do this job. I mean, I gained a lot of experience negotiating, investigating, people skills, team building, some training and things like that with the prior job that's helped me now.
Honestly, I think your whole career has been developing those people skills and response skills just in slightly different ways that kind of almost culminates to where you are right now.
Yeah, it's also been difficult because, as you could tell, I don't have the most forceful voice. I'm calling people sounding like this little girl from the South, trying to tell CEOs and presidents of the company why they should pay a claim they are totally against paying, or the issues that they have with the situation that may blow up into something worse, even with the truck drivers, like, why are you, or trucking companies? Because I would talk to the safety directors and things like that, and just getting all the pushback. And I've been in some uncomfortable situations while out in the field because I've been in areas that didn't welcome people that look like me. It's really all about knowing that you have the talent and the abilities to do your job. And if other people don't want to get on board with that, that's fine. I know how to remain professional, but yet get my point across. Yeah, I just made an insurer mad at me yesterday. And I'm like, okay, sorry. Just doing my job.
Yeah. And like, look, I actually think it is a bonus that you have such a nice affect that you can have a thick skin and be stern and you have a nice delivery to it, that sometimes it makes the blow a little bit easier. I think that sometimes the bulldog mentality, I think, doesn't always work. Yeah. I mean, I like to akin myself to kind of to how you are when I deal with opposing counsel. I'm not in it to just argue and fight with them. Yeah. Like that, I don't think that gets us anywhere. I mean, sure, there's a time and a place for it, of course, yeah. But generally speaking, we don't need to come in claws out, ready to, you know, ready to fight. And that more approachable, nicer affect, I personally think gets you further along in life. Yeah. But there are plenty of people who might disagree with me, but that's my view.
Yeah, I've always been like a compromiser. I'm very gray. I don't think everything's black and white, and kind of see both sides. And even when I have something difficult to say, I usually try to start out with something positive. Like even getting an email from someone that I know we're about to have a conflict, I'm like, well, thank you for your email. But, you know, so there's just a way to approach that you can stand by what you believe in and try to get the job done without taking any kind of insults or whatever personally. It's hard to not take it personally. So I'm an emotional person, but I know at the end of the day, if it's a situation where I didn't do anything wrong, that keeps me kind of grounded.
Yeah. And like, I think you've also built up this thicker skin, so to speak, that over the years of having to have a lot of difficult conversations and experiences. Although I can imagine being where you are now, if someone is questioning like your assessment or your ability, that's hard.
Give them their options and make them make the decision and live with the consequences. Yeah. That's my motto. Like, you know, I can only advise you, but you know, in our business, you just kind of got to let things unfold. I mean, you give insurance or whomever advice that's expected of you, but if they make a choice that lead to other consequences, just it is what it is.
Yeah. And look, you know, I think every aspect, like from when you were a 911 operator versus responding to the catastrophic claims, like you're dealing with high emotions. And when dealing with high emotions, you need to not have the high emotions to bring everyone down.
But it's not to say that I don't take stuff home, especially like at my previous job when I was getting called out a lot. I'm like, why is everybody dying on my time? You know, like, you know, I felt, I was just emotional for a while. You know, I'm a spiritual person. I believe in God and that he puts you in places that you need to be. And maybe it was meant for me to be there at that time with that driver, helping him, whatever. It was just mentally draining on me too. After I went home, I'm like, what just happened? What did I see?
You can't really talk about it.
Can't really talk about it.
So you just have to kind of like sit in your soup, and that's like not always fun.
Not at all.
So what did you do to help yourself through that? Like, do you journal, or, I mean, how did you help yourself process through it?
I don't think I did. I just was, I feel like my went, no, like, it was such a, it's just so heavy all the time. That coupled with being a single mom, I didn't have time for myself. And so now turning the page, doing a different direction in professional liability, I'm finally, and my son is grown, you know, doing his thing. I'm finally getting back to what I care about or what I like to do, which I don't even know what I like to do because I haven't done anything for so long. It's just weird. It's weird to let go of all that heaviness and to actually have free time to myself. I don't even know what to do.
I don't know. A lot of people play pickleball. Maybe you should play pickleball.
No. I do need a hobby.
I understand though. I mean, just from when you go from spending so much of your time like concentrating on your career and then young children and like just you put it all into all the other things, you often just forget about yourself. And I struggle with it all the time. I used to have hobbies, but I'm like, who has time for hobbies? I don't know. I'm actually making it this year. I'm like, I said, I'm gonna just take more time just to read for pleasure, not for any intellectual purpose, just for just pleasure for 3 weeks, and I'm doing a terrible job at it. So I need to do better. But it's like that same idea. Like, we shouldn't feel guilty about carving out time every day for ourselves. Otherwise, you lose kind of like you get a little lost.
Yeah, you're right.
I encourage you to try to find something for yourself. I don't know what it is.
I'm trying, maybe.
Crocheting. I don't know.
Well, my mom bought me a sewing machine 2 years ago. And she's like, you even get out the box. I was like, well, I got it out the closet and put it on the table, but it's still in the box. So I'm going to get it out. I'm going to start sewing, I think.
I think that's an amazing step one.
Just getting it out in front of you to see it. And then maybe you'll open the box.
I do want you to email me when you take it out of the box. And then like when you get your first pattern of what you're going to make, maybe start with the scrunchie. That's what we did.
I got the pattern. I got the material. I got everything.
You're well on your way.
I haven't opened the box.
Well, Tracy, we are just about out of time, but before we close up, this is something I ask of most of my guests, like knowing what you know now and where you are, what advice would you give young Tracy when, you know, she's graduating college and deciding, you know, law school's not for me? What advice would you give her?
Well, you know, I don't have any regrets because things happen the way they were supposed to happen. The only thing I wish I would have, we didn't get into this, but I did have a short stint in web development. Like, I left insurance to go do the .com thing and web development. And because I was self-taught by this guy in the computer lab at college, like, he taught me how to code by HTML, whatever. But I wish I knew that was a career. Because I probably would have went into web development and things like that. But by the time I tried it when I was in Atlanta, it was just, you had to have a lot of experience to really thrive in that. So I went back to insurance. Just what I would tell my younger self is just don't be afraid to try new things. Because I felt like I was just on a path of what people expected me to be on. I was the first one to graduate from college in our family. I think the lawyer thing just kind of was an expectation at a certain point. So I just finished my degree, but then I was like, no, I'm not doing it. I don't know, just not be afraid of trying new things. I think I stayed in fear for too long and kind of got stuck for too long.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's great advice. Like, I often say that to my daughter, who's just young and decides, like, oh, I want to be this when I grow up. I'm like, like, we don't need to decide this right now. Like, I changed my mind like 15 times. People change their minds during their careers. So I always try to encourage her, just do something now. Like, think that you have to do something because you thought at 11, that's what you should do, you know, and have an open mind. So, but I'm sure that you felt pressure too, being the first to graduate, and there's definitely pressure there.
Yeah. And just having to find my own way, because typically when a person goes to college and they have family members that's already been, you get that guidance and kind of like that mentorship. They kind of help you guide and make decisions. And I didn't have that.
Yeah.
You know, so I kind of like had a trial and error, make decisions on what path to take. So.
Yeah. Well, you're not alone. You know, it made you who you are today. That's not a bad. Well, Tracy, I appreciate you so much taking the time out today to share your career, share a lot of personal anecdotes, and I really appreciate you coming on and chatting with me. And for, you know, the listeners out there, if you like what you hear, please like and subscribe to Claims Never Sleep. You can find us on all your favorite streaming platforms as well as YouTube. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is the Claims Never Sleep podcast, presented by Cruiser Mitchell, with your host, Megan Henry.